That's how we should start this one off.
What's that?
Only one man in the universe dare give me the raspberry. Lone Star.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Junkies, and welcome to another episode of Junk Food Cinema here on Film School Rejects. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is better than just alright. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am joined, as always, by my friend and cohort is a word I just can't fucking say, and I put it into these like intros like at least five times. Cohort novelist slash screenwriter Mr. C. Robert Cargill,
who happens to live three blocks from the place where Matthew McConaughey first delivered his first line, all right,
which is of course Top Notch here in Austin, Texas.
Oh yes.
Heyo.
I love Top Notch.
Want to remind you that we are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. As we continue through McGenre, hey!
All right.
It's a wazzy, it's a woozy, it's a...
Bring down the beast!
McGenre, hey, baby.
We arrive at a film that I'd hazard four people listening may have heard of, but it also happens to be a favorite of my friend Cargill's here.
Oh, God, yes. If Junk Food Cinema has a patron saint... it's John Sayles. It is writer turned director John Sayles. He is, there are so many movies that we can choose from that have impacted us from his early Carpenter days to his later era. I know you're a huge fan of Alligator. We both love Piranha. We're both huge fans, and I'm a gargantuan fan of
Battle Beyond the Stars. Yep.
And there's another movie that has a star of this movie that we need to cover ASAP. I realized this while rewatching this movie.
Get your beers ready for the drinking game where we talk about shows or movies we'll cover in future shows, but not on this show.
But not on this show. This show we will not talk about Brother from Another Planet.
Which
we must cover. But today we're talking about what is arguably John Sayles' best film.
I would agree with that. And I think there's recognition that he got for this movie to back that up.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say this. I agree wholeheartedly that John Sayles should be our patron saint. If Roger Corman is our god, then John Sayles is absolutely our patron saint. I think that's how that hierarchy breaks down. The film.
How did you mention Roger Corman without mentioning the Corman alarm?
Oh, you're right. There it is. Awesome. Shit. I forgot about the Corman alarm. Thank God that came back.
We haven't talked about a Corman film in long enough that you forgot about the Corman
alarm. So many people just ecstatic that the goddamn Corman alarm is back, but it's back. But yeah, today's film is Lone Star. And Cargo, I'm going to turn over the reins to you, at least for the initial kickoff of this discussion.
Okay, so you know, this is one of those movies that's really important in who I am as a film critic. I was a big fan of Joel Siegel, who was a film critic for ABC News for a long time. He was Good Morning America's critic for a long time. And I grew up watching him. And he did the Best of the Year list that changed the way I looked at Best of the Year lists and informed the way that I ended up writing them when I became a critic. And on his list, he talked about the best films of the year, but he stressed the fact that, look, what I'm going to tell you about are the films that not only I think are the best of the year, but the films that I think you really need to go out of your way and see because they aren't the stuff that you would traditionally see. And he tried to create a list, at least in this particular year, that was really outside of the box. And this was in the middle of his list. And he had said something that I will never forget. He said, if I could forget one movie and go back and rewatch that movie without knowing what I know about the end of that movie, this would be the movie I would do it with.
Absolutely.
And having rewatched it just again this weekend, it did, that line hit me so profoundly again, because what he says changes what happens at the end of this movie changes everything about this movie. And this movie is so goddamn good. John Sayles is an amazing screenwriter who started his career writing schlock genre and writing it so good that here we are, 35 years later, still reeling in the pleasures of what he was playing around with. And then he moved on to more important work and became an Oscar caliber filmmaker who then, started to fade into an indie, an ex-Oscar caliber indie filmmaker, making his films that were his own voice and his own vision. And Lone Star is his film in which he goes and it's one of his only films where he's aping someone else, and he apes the Coen brothers.
Very much so. Yeah.
But he doesn't truly ape the Coen brothers. He doesn't try to capture the goofy, zany comedy of the Coen brothers, but he tries to make a Coen brothers movie with that Coen brothers spirit and the darkness of it. He captures it perfectly and ends up creating a wonderful story about myth building.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And it is a story. This is now here's the thing that needs to be stressed. We're doing a month of McConaughey movies. McConaughey is barely in this movie. He is in exactly three scenes of this movie. There are only three scenes that Matthew McConaughey is in. Forget the cover. Forget the fact that his face is the biggest on the front of the VHS cover when this came out, and now the DVD cover and on your VOD, because he was the big star at the time. He wasn't quite a big star when he shot this, but then he blew up, and they're like, we've got Matthew McConaughey in this movie. We absolutely put him at the forefront.
Is this film even available on DVD?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because I've only ever seen, looking through the artwork, I had to find this online, and I was only able to track down, VHS copies, so I was just curious.
I could have swore there was a DVD. If there wasn't a DVD put out, I'm kind of heartbroken. But yes, it is I know that it's readily available.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah, it's readily available on VOD. I mean, it is not a hard movie to find. This is not exactly Skate Town USA that we're talking about.
That's true. That's true. But I just want to, off of something you said, Matthew McConaughey, yes, is not in this movie. Very much like Frailty, he bookends it. And yet, both in terms of the character's impact on the story and a testament to McConaughey's performance, is that he makes his presence felt.
He is a shadow in every scene of this fucking movie.
He looms large over everything that happens, and even after his character's death, he's discussed as if he were some law enforcement legend.
They called him a legend. They called him a champion of justice.
The day that man died, they broke the damn mold.
He is talked about as a legend, and without McConaughey's performance, this movie would not totally work.
Yeah.
And the thing is, in that opening scene with him, Matthew McConaughey stands toe-to-toe with, in his fucking prime, Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
This is Kris Kristofferson at his oldest and wisest and most powerful before he was starting to, as time does, starting to wear down on you. And it is these two guys, this young kid and this old guy, who, as you find out, is one of the premium grade cocksuckers ever to walk the fucking earth, are standing toe to toe in the scene, and McConaughey fucking does it. He pulls it off. Two Southern legends in a scene together, being alpha male the alpha male, and McConaughey holds his fucking ground. And this is young McConaughey. And it is just, from that moment on, you feel McConaughey in, I would argue, all but two scenes in the movie. There are two scenes where you do not feel McConaughey looming. Every other scene, he's referenced or you feel him. And it is so good.
It's not a supernatural film, but his ghost is everywhere in this movie. And that is one of the things I enjoyed the most. And yes, Kris Kristofferson turns in a dusty, growling, superb performance.
Let's tell everybody what this movie's about.
So the structure of this movie is that at the beginning of the film, these two guys are out at what is used to be a shooting range, and they are collecting shell casings.
And in true Coen Brothers fashion, it's two guys just riffing on fucking nothing.
Yes. Yeah, no, absolutely. And so they're looking around, and then one of them finds a skeleton, which leads to the discovery then of a sheriff's badge, which leads to the discovery of... So basically, they're trying to figure out... First, they're trying to figure out who... the body is, and everyone's pretty sure it was the town sheriff from the 60s who went missing, who was the sheriff above. So, okay, yeah, I got to try and keep this straight because it's told in multiple generations.
Let me jump in.
It's told across multiple generations out of chronological order. So
the protagonist of this story is played by Chris Cooper. Before American Beauty had happened, so nobody really knew who this guy was. Nobody knew that he was this young gem of an actor who had proved to be one of the great character actors of his day. And Chris Cooper is the son of Matthew McConaughey, who is the town legend. He has been sheriff for some nearly 40 years, gets reelected every few years. Everyone in town loves him. Everyone in town's kind of afraid of him, but everyone in town at the same time respects him. Like, he's the guy that they sell the myth of. It's like, it doesn't matter what color you were in this town. If you had a dispute with someone, you called the sheriff. Mm-hmm. And so this guy is living in the shadow of his own father. And this guy famously stood toe-to-toe with the fucking sheriff, gave the sheriff what for.
How about you lay that shield on this table and vanish?
And the sheriff took off, and the local legend was the sheriff skipped town with $10,000 and was never heard from again. Then we find the sheriff's body, and all of a sudden, the new sheriff of this town is investigating a murder that his father may have committed.
His father is the prime suspect, and yet, you have all this evidence being kind of public knowledge, and yet you don't hear anybody in town subscribing to the idea that Chris Cooper's dad, Buddy, who is played in flashback by Matthew McConaughey, actually did this.
Yeah.
Everyone just keeps talking. Everyone seems to have more horror stories about the sheriff above Chris Cooper's father than they do suspicions that Buddy, again played by Matthew McConaughey, is the one that killed the former sheriff. And I think structurally, I think the movie's most intriguing in its structure. Because first of all, there's the setting.
Yeah.
So John Sayles is a guy who grew up on the East Coast, you know, in New York and in Boston. And for this film, Sayles takes a film about difficult familial histories that span three generations. And he sets it in Texas, which is arguably the state in the country most obsessed with its own history. Like, and that's underscored in the movie by there are these constant arguments. It's these, like, the city council is arguing about these textbooks that recontextualize the Battle of the Alamo that say maybe these, you know, these three figures that are held up as Texas legends weren't the heroes that everybody thinks. It basically provides a more a less mythic, more factual accounting of the Battle of the Alamo, and the white people in town are fighting tooth and nail to not change the textbooks, which I think is part of the reason why this particular film takes place, why this Texas story exists, is because it is a story about dealing with the idea and the perception of a local legend versus the uglier truth. And in this case, it also is about sins of the father. I mean, there's several storylines running through this movie about, you know, various sins committed by various fathers. But I think the reason structurally, like, that it fascinated me so much is that you do have a movie about personal histories taking place in the state that I would argue, again, is most obsessed with its own history.
I'll take it a step further. The thing is, you know, as you mentioned at the head of this this episode, I'm really excited about this. I love the fuck out of this movie. One of the things I love about this is I would find this arguably the most Texas movie ever made by a Northeasterner. I mean, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Every scene of this movie feels like Texas. Every time you're sitting in you're sitting in a restaurant, you're sitting in a bar, drinking a beer, it nails Texas. It nails the feel. It nails the cheapness. It nails the pageantry. It nails everything about, you know, what it's like to live in Texas. And then the entire movie and its theme is about the incestuousness of Texas and how we have such a deeply complicated history and we just kind of let the stories go right. and kind of let the stories stay as they are because it's better than actually having to explain the truth.
Exactly.
The,
yeah, that's what I'm truth, saying.
No, that's I'm agreeing with you. Yeah. I'm not arguing. I'm agreeing. I'm just taking it a step further because it is really that is what Texas is Texas. Our history is messy as fuck. It's messier than most people who live out of Texas actually acknowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, here in Texas, we acknowledge that we're part of the South, but we like to think of ourselves as the Southwest because we don't like to talk about the fact that when we joined the Union, we had slaves and we were totally down with the slave thing. We pretend that shit never happened. You never hear anything. Any talk about slaves in Texas. Yeah, we have a large black community in Houston, but we don't know how that happened. that just kind of happened. We don't know. Slavery. We were kind of technically part of the Confederacy, but not really. We don't openly, that's stuff that is just all brushed over. Mm-hmm. But we do talk about the Alamo. And then when you get into the deeper stuff of the Alamo, you get into Santa Ana, you start getting into what guys were at the Alamo and why they were there. And you start getting into the real stories, which, by the way, John Sayles is obsessed with. He took a pass at the remake of the Alamo, which was actually where the Alamo lost its epicness and got muddled along the way, where Disney's like, hey, we'll bring in this guy who's obsessed with the Alamo, John Sayles, who's also a brilliant screenwriter, who then is like, oh, hey, by the way, you got a lot of this wrong. Let me fix that. Oh, shit. Now it's a shitty movie because, hey, by the way, these guys weren't all as awesome as we like to think.
So Sayles wanted the version of the film that would have been in the textbooks that they're arguing about in this movie.
In this movie.
Yeah.
And so Sayles is a guy who's obsessed, or I won't say obsessed because I don't know him personally, but who clearly understands and loves Texas and fucking gets it. And I'll fucking make him an honorary Texan right now if I can, because nobody's made a movie as deeply Texan as Lone Star is. It is, if you've ever spent any time in small town Texas, this movie nails it. I mean, yeah. It really, really captures that essence of what the people are like and the goodness to them and how they kind of brush over the not so goodness to them. And I love how this movie is dealing with that with McConaughey,
yeah.
Where, you know, everybody knows Buddy wasn't the best guy in the world, but Buddy was the best guy in the world. Yeah. And that's what's important. And look, there's never going to be another guy like Buddy. And yeah, sure, Buddy had his flaws, but we don't talk about that.
Yeah.
And this film, that's fucking Texas.
And I think it's interesting, too, with most films that want to, you know, tap into what a particular region is all about. You know, one of the tricks that they'll employ is, you know, jargon and accent, and neither of those things feel like they are superseding character and dialogue. And his dialogue in this movie is so incredibly organic.
Like, oh yeah,
it's very blue collar, and it feels like if you've ever played like one of those mystery video games where the only way that you're going to get to the next level is by talking to people long enough to hear one thing that they say and go, wait a minute, what, and then you put that, like, it really does, it gives you everything that you need, and yet is presented in such a way, such an artistic way, that you almost don't even realize that you're being told plot points. You almost don't realize that you're being told things that you need, because it feels like you've lived in this community for years. And there's also a very theatrical quality, like, you can see, As people are speaking, you can kind of see the beats, you know, that Sayles has written in, and they work so well. And it's rare that I enjoyed listening to a movie as much as I enjoyed listening to this one.
Yeah.
And just listening to the specific flow and the brilliance of this dialogue.
There's only one scene that's questionable in the entire movie, and I love it. My wife did not, and this was the one discussion. She had never seen this movie. Or no, she had seen it, but had completely forgotten the twist of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it just bugged her. And it's this what I think is an amazing scene in which Frances McDormand shows up as Chris Cooper's wife. And this is where the Coen brothers' nature of what this is comes. It's like, oh, hey, it's Mrs. Coen showing up in a scene where she's a Coen brothers character.
Right.
And but she's so great. But at the same time, is not only is she a Coen brothers character in the scene, she's also the stereotype of the Austin sports obsessed nut job, which then turns into has a lot of weight to it because, as it turns out, she has a number of issues of her own. But, you know, here she is, you know, it is so weird because it was one of those awkward experiences where it's she's talking about, you know, the game in which A&M plays against UT, where my wife went to school, and then talks about, hey, you know, we're really excited about this young kid from Churchill, which is the high school my wife went to, who's, and is, they're talking about it in the year that my wife graduated. She's like, we didn't have a 350 pound. We didn't have a football team that played at all. Like John Sayles. And I'm like, honey, no, this is fiction. They're allowed to talk about your high school and pretend that your high school had a good team that year and a good player. And she's like, no, this is the stereotype that everyone makes fun of. And I'm like, yes, that's the point. And but she's doing a great job of it, and clearly there's more to it than we're making fun of Texas. It's here's a woman who's serious, who's clearly got issues and seriously has issues, and John Sayles treats that entire scene in which he kind of pokes fun at our, you know, the Texans' love of sports, while also then humanizing it in such a brilliant way. And I fell in love with that scene all over again. It was one of my favorite scenes in the movie. The first time I saw it and rewatching it, it was just like, oh my God, that scene. It starts off so goofy. It's like, you know, one of the people we reference every once in a while, you know, Harry Knowles, who, you know, is a fellow film critic who gave me my first shot. Every Saturday during UT season, all of a sudden he stops being a film geek and all of a sudden he becomes a football expert on Twitter and starts analyzing every play of the game. And it's one of those, it's like, Harry, you're kind of being the Austin cliche here. You know, you realize that this is the Central Texas joke. And, but here, you know, it's, that's just, you know, that happens. And here Sayles takes a really good swipe at it while also then perfectly humanizing it.
And I want to go back, for a moment to the idea of sins of the father. Cause you do have,
oh yes,
you have a number of different situations in this movie where kind of like, again, the legend of, or the reputation of characters in this movie really become truth over actual truth.
Well, there's an actual entire storyline from this movie that the studio in this day and age might want to excise because it doesn't actually play into the real plot of the movie. Mm-hmm. It just further fleshes out a character who ends up being very important in the movie, but really mostly plays to what you're talking about, which is about the sins of the father.
Yeah. And to the, I mean, it does so in such an elegant way that the movie actually feels Shakespearean at times.
Yeah.
Like it feels like, you know, somebody who is being told these epic tales of the good deeds of you know, their ancestors. And it's just, and the thing that's most fascinating to me is Chris Cooper's diligent investigation of this murder.
And of his own dad.
And it's like, you realize the rest of the town is telling him in no uncertain terms, just let it go.
Let it go.
And it's almost like he's reached a point where he has a personal grudge against his father, which the movie goes into, but it's almost like he is the one character in the movie who absolutely positively refuses to buy into legend. Like he's the character who is trying to get at truth while everyone else is content to believe the legend. And I think that's such a, internally has to be such a conflicting thing and makes these characters so much more rich. That he's investigating this murder for which his father is the prime suspect, and he's really the only one who cares whether his dad did this or not.
Yeah, and to him, his dad is still that guy who showed up at the movie theater and dragged him out of the car, that Mexican girl.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's there at a movie theater, you know, or at a drive-in, making out with his hands on the boobs of some Mexican girl, and that's not going to fly, not in his house.
Which, again, like any other screenwriter, it would have been, that was the reason he was investigating his dad and trying to get to the truth, because he had this grudge. And it would have just been that his dad didn't like the interracial thing, and it was a subtle note to Texas racism. And then when you get to the other twist at the end of the movie,
oh my God,
it makes that conflict so much more just like, holy shit.
And now here's the point where we tell you, if you haven't seen Lone Star, pause it right here, because we're about to get into the nitty gritty of this movie. And again, another twisty turny McConaughey movie in which the twist we have to talk about because it informs what this movie's about.
Yeah.
So pause it now, because I'm about to drop it.
I just think people ought to know the full story on Buddy Deeds.
When you get to the twist, as it turns out, Chris Cooper, the love of his life, this beautiful woman who he loved as a teenage girl, who he's pined for, who he married the wrong girl, still dreaming of getting together with her, who moves back to the small town just because he knows she's there and her husband has died, and he has this offhand hope that he will one day run into her and maybe rekindle things, is actually his half-sister.
Yikes.
That his dad was fucking around on his mom, who everybody always says, your mother was a saint. Your mother was a saint. Your mother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why was his mother a saint? Because she had dad back after he screwed around with that Mexican widow.
Yeah.
And that Mexican widow popped out his little baby girl, who happened to be the same age as his baby boy. And they grew up together in the same fucking school. They felt this connection, which they mistook for love. They then had a relationship and only find out in their 30s that, by the way, we have the same dad.
Yeah.
And that not only is a truly wonderful, profoundly fucked up story that really makes this movie as great as it is, but it's also an amazing metaphor for, as I said earlier, just how incestuous the Texas history is, about how we like to pretend that we're a bunch of whites who just kind of moved in and the Mexicans wanted this land back that they didn't want, even though they were here all along. And we try to pretend that the Mexicans keep coming over when really our histories are the same and somebody just drew a line somewhere and we started one day acting like that line meant something.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, this is as much a land for the Latinos as it is for the whites. And we've all been here and we all keep pretending that we're two separate, you know, peoples that have separate histories. But really here in Texas, it's the same fucking history.
But I like that it's not clear cut. I like that it's not like you said, it's incestuous. I like that but it's not even an issue historically. Even the movie's historical perspective is kind of made more complicated by certain characters in the movie. You know, the woman that we're talking about, who we find out had an affair with Buddy, Matthew McConaughey's character.
Yeah. Oh.
There's a scene in the movie where she's sitting in her backyard and sees two illegal immigrants come running through her yard because they don't live, they're a border town, they're far from the border. She calls INS.
She calls La Migra.
Yeah.
She just all of a sudden she calls Border Patrol.
Yeah.
And she's like, fucking immigrants. And then later in the movie, we find out, we watch the scene where she comes through and in John Sayles' brilliance, we think this is a flashback of several of the characters we've just watched cross the river and have problems.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it's her. And so she initially, and here's this guy who she's been giving a ride home from work, and he's a wonderful guy, and he's just this wonderful guy who's just really adapting. And he finds out that he's married, but he's married for a green card, and he's been working everything up to get his real wife and his baby across the river over into Texas for a better life. And she's ready to call Border Patrol. And then she's suddenly reminded of who she is. And all of a sudden she becomes that person. And then we find out that that young girl is the wife of this guy we watched murdered in cold blood. And she's this widow immigrant stuck in this town who gets taken under the wing by this young deputy turned sheriff, who then falls for her. Mm-hmm. And ends up having a relationship with her and ends up having a baby girl with her. And it is so John Sayles, for fuck's sake.
Because nothing is as easy as you think it is. Like, nothing in this movie is as easy as it appears. Like, no relationship is as cut and dry as you would think. No story is as factual as you think. Like, it's all, like, there's hidden stuff everywhere.
That great underappreciated performance by the guy who's the old deputy, who's telling the old stories of Buddy and who's like Buddy's, you know, torchbearer, and who you, the whole movie, you're sitting there and you're going, this guy's just full of shit. He's covering up for his buddy. He's telling lies about this guy that didn't really exist. And then we get to the final scene and find out he's the fucking killer.
Yeah.
That he's gunned down the sheriff in the back because he was about to kill this poor young black kid for fucking bullshit. He watched him do it earlier. He watched him kill this fucking Latino kid. He's gonna kill this black kid the same fucking way as this fucking bigoted piece of shit. And he fucking kills him. And then is in shock at what he's done. Mm-hmm. And here comes Buddy, just, and McConaughey in pure form, just the way he just, in with no dialogue, just reaching out and lowering the guy's gun.
Yeah.
And just the look on his face, the pained agony, but this ties into this line that we just heard a few scenes before, is like, Buddy had a greater sense of justice than any man who ever lived. And it's because we see that in McConaughey's performance, we see it in that old actor's performance, we see it in the young actor playing him, you know, in which we have this profound sense of Buddy understood that guy needed to die.
Right.
That guy was a piece of shit and was making the town worse. And we're just going to take care of this. And we're going to pretend nothing ever happened. And we're going to tell a story that I chased him out of town and I was Captain Big Shit. And I'm going to turn that into the myth that will get me elected sheriff. And then I'm going to run this town for 40 years and make sure that everybody is safe. And for 40 years, everybody is.
Yeah.
And the whole reason why Chris Cooper is even elected sheriff is because he has the same last name.
Yeah.
Not because he's this incredible lawman. He didn't even want to be a lawman. He wanted to get back in town so he could sleep with the girl he was in love with in high school. And here he's chasing down the myth of his father, thinks it's about to be debunked. And instead, it's all reiterated. His father was a fucking giant. Yeah, his father had his demons, but his father is actually a bigger legend than the legend everyone tells.
Yeah.
That he was truly this really great man who instead allowed people to say he was a kind of great man. And that's just fucking cool.
And there's the moment that kind of crystallizes all of this when Chris Cooper is at the unveiling of a statue to his father, and you realize at the end of the movie that the sheriff who, I mean, and keep in mind,
as much as great on many
as
levels,
much as people loved Buddy, this whole covering up a murder thing is not the only corrupt thing he's ever done. They talk throughout the whole movie about how he used influence to help his friends out. You realize why specifically these friends, but still, like, the cover up of this murder was not the only corrupt thing he's ever done, and yet people are building a fucking statue. Like, crystallize.
They got that great plaque of him on the courthouse.
Yeah.
And I love the moment where his buddy, the old deputy, just is like, I think he's going to run that poor little Latino kid, that poor little Latino kid in for loitering. it's a picture of Buddy with his hand in the kid. Just, that's the joke his friend makes. And
yeah,
it's like, that's who the guy was.
And yet they're built, like, it, again, hearkening back to this idea that sometimes we prefer the myth. Sometimes we prefer the legend to the truth,
yeah,
because the truth is ugly and not as romantic. In that moment, if you're going back and you watch that movie again, you realize they've erected a statue to a guy that we find out has covered up murder, has had this this illegitimate child while he was married, and it's just and now there's a statue to him, and the only thing anyone's going to remember is the statue and the stories.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things I've met some going to townie bars, which I do sometimes, just the stories that you hear older Texans tell, like it's incredible. Like, there's this rich mythos about everything that's ever happened in their life. It's like listening to the Iliad 30 times a day, you know? It's amazing. And I feel like
down here, we call it the Iliad.
The Iliad. I drive an Odyssey, so I call it the Iliad. What I found really appealing about Lone Star, though, is it, again, going back to structure, is that it starts out as a Southern fried noir. Like, it starts out like, you know exactly it's going to be police procedural,
yeah,
know, what have you. And then it becomes something far more substantial right in the middle. I mean, this is a crime film in which the crime is a catalyst for an intensely human story. it is not the most identifying thing about the movie. That, you know, it's not pulp, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. The crime story aspect isn't necessarily lost in the shuffle with the drama and the romance. It simmers underneath every moment.
Yeah.
And yet again, it's not how you would identify the movie. I mean, I felt like, you know, coupled with Sales' engaging dialogue, that's what keeps this movie from ever feeling cheap or ordinary. And that was really fascinating to me, that he was able to take something that we had seen before and then use it to tell a story that didn't usually gel with our conventional descriptions of genre or categories of genre.
Yeah.
And I liked that a lot.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is that's the whole reason why I recommended this was, you know, you are occasionally a stickler for genre, mm-hmm. with making sure junk food cinema flows properly. And this is one of those films where I'm like, this is really kind of teetering on the bubble, but right. I can make the argument for it because it's a cold case Southern fried noir movie. And despite the fact that there's this very human story going on, almost every scene of this movie is all about this guy trying to solve this crime and this old crime, even though these actors who are in these scenes are barely in the movie. Chris Christopherson and Matthew McConaughey, despite being the biggest faces on the cover of the fucking box,
such big
and
faces.
The poster, are barely in the movie. Like, they were what brought everyone in. And then everyone was just like, wait, who's this guy and this girl? I don't understand what this, I thought there was going to be some Matthew McConaughey. And that was the joke at the time, which was like, oh, hey, look, here's Matthew McConaughey. Oh, there he's gone. And yet you go back and you revisit this and it's like, wow, how smart that was of Sales.
Yeah.
And you know, how he, everything in this movie is deceptive. Like everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what I think is so brilliant about it. And just so wildly brilliant about it is that it's a story about it's a deceptive story about a deceptive town.
Yeah.
And that you never quite know what's going on. And then once you do, when you go back, it all makes sense. Like, watching this through a second time, you understand why everybody tells the lies they tell.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of realize, yeah, these are the stories they have to tell.
Yeah.
Like, how would you tell the real story here? And why would you tell the real story?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, why would you tell, you know, Buddy's wife was a saint. Why would you bring up the other woman? That was only a couple of years. It was a couple of years out of 40. And he was kind of a fuck up and he screwed up and he got back on the horse and everything was cool. And we just kind of pretend.
That's really terrible that you would describe her as a horse.
That Buddy did not, you know, let me go with the Texasisms, Indianapolis. we'll just kind of pretend that didn't happen. Like, there's that great scene where he's like, you know, I heard my buddy had a woman. Yeah, he did. But, you know, over the years, it's the problem with being old is you learn a new name, you got to forget an old one. I couldn't even tell you who that was. That scene, you know, the first time you hear it, you think that's legit. And the second time you're like, oh, that old Indian's full of shit.
Yeah.
That guy's lying. Like, he knows exactly who that is, but he's not going to sell Buddy up the river because Buddy was good to him.
Yeah.
And Buddy's not even going to tell Buddy's son after Buddy's dead who he was fucking around on his mom with.
Yeah.
And it's just, this whole movie is just layered with stuff like that. And it's so well done. And it's so well done that you believe the lies the first time around. And then once you know the truth, you kind of want to believe the lies. And it's the sheer brilliance of everything Sales was working towards as a writer and as a director, all coalescing into one. You know, in a film that seems to at first ape the Coens, ends up turning into a perfect John Sayles film.
And it's funny, too, because the idea of a town with a secret is kind of a staple of noir storytelling. But this particular town has like a massive hidden reserve of secrets buried below the ground. And yet nobody seems like Chris Cooper is the most, like I said, the most diligent person investigating this murder. But even the people covering it up, there's not really there's nothing seedy about it almost. Like, no. You know what I mean? Like, they don't, it's not that they're trying to cover it up. It's not that they don't want this secret to get out. They just would rather forget. Like, it's just such a passive thing. It's like,
the good guys,
we just rather believe he's good.
The good guys killed the bad guy. And, but if good guys admitted they killed the bad guy, the good guys would be in prison and then the bad guys would be in charge again. Fuck it. We'll lie about that. Oh, hey, this really good young girl fell in love with a white guy who was a good guy. And they had some fun together and they fucked around and then they got their shit together. And then you come to realize that that girl never stopped loving that guy, which is why she never got married again. But we just, let's pretend that, you know, she was just too busy with work and her kids to ever find the right guy. No, you get that she fell in love with him. That's, you know, she fell in love with Buddy. And every scene in the movie, when you watch it the second time, you're like, oh shit, that was the love of her life. You know, she came over with this young guy, the first guy she loved, you know, who was brutally killed. But the guy who was responsible for taking out that guy in some regard, that guy took care of me. That guy set me up with my business. That guy took, you know, that guy, that's the guy I fell in love with. So no, I never loved anyone else because to me, everyone else was just some guy with grease under his nails because he wasn't Buddy.
Yeah.
And this entire movie is just layered with this stuff. Like every single character that has any lines at all has that kind of weight to them. And you know who we haven't talked about and who we should move into because we keep talking about that story. And you've hinted at, but the story with Joe Morton. And Joe Morton is a regular in John Sayles movies and is a wonderful character actor who we'll talk about later when we finally get around to talking about Brother from Another Planet. Because we really need to talk about Brother from Another Planet.
Yep.
Do your homework now. Watch Brother from Another Planet after you watch Lone Star. You will not regret that double feature. Maybe watch him the other way around, Brother from Another Planet, and then Lone Star.
Yeah, probably.
But if you're listening to this point of Lone Star, we've kind of fucked Lone Star for you. You'll still love the shit out of it because it's brilliantly put together. If you didn't listen to us before and fucking take our advice, we've totally spoiled every mystery of this film. But Joe Morton has this whole dual conflict, and one is with his son, who is upset at the general as he's kind of
He's a military guy.
He's a colonel who's stationed at the local base. But he's also, he's bitter at his father, who lives in this small town that he's just been forced to move back into, who is a local legend, who is the guy who runs the bar where all of the blacks always felt safe. And there were never any other black places in town that are as profound as this in the community, which is a plot point in the movie. But, you know, because as it turns out, Sheriff Buddy made sure that never happened, that any other black clubs that opened in town were strongly discouraged. And that was part of, you know, his payoff for the end of the movie. But it is.
It's also part of the reason he was paid off throughout the movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's. But that's one of those things. It's three guys who end up in a fucked up situation together. They were all in the wrong, and all being in the wrong together, they stick together. And rather than I know what you did last summer, it's here's 40 years of us running the town together. Because none of us can betray the other. And so we all end up becoming friends about it. But so Joe Morton has this problem with his dad who ran out on him and ran out on him in the worst way, like left him and his mom to move three doors down. At their mom's friend's house. And that wasn't even where he ended up. Like he went through a series of women after that, cause that's just who he was.
Yeah.
And so Joe Morton has to reckon with the fact that he's living in the same small town as his dad who ran off on him and has a son who really wants to get to know his grandfather, who wants to know his history, and his dad doesn't want him to know it because he knows his dad is a shit.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely a character-driven movie. Like I said before, what sets us apart from other kind of cold case noir stuff that you might have seen is that more than a cover-up, what's really going on here is a fish story.
Yeah.
Because Buddy even has, I mean, the reason Buddy decides not to prosecute Hollis for shooting the former sheriff is specifically because he knows that if the sheriff just disappears, everyone's going to assume that Buddy killed him. That is going to be an open secret. And he knows that his reputation can actually withstand that. Whereas if he prosecutes Hollis and Hollis is just the murderer, it's he's not going to have that same experience.
I don't know if he assumes that per se, because the whole town loves the story of the sheriff running with the tail between his legs.
Right, but they all, but you know as well as I do, this is a town that will say that they believe this story when they really know. I mean, that's again, that's what we've been talking about this whole time, is deciding to believe the legend when you know the truth is ugly. So I think it's absolutely the fact that he knows that everyone is, I mean, that's why people tell the fucking Chris Cooper to stop investigating.
Yeah.
They know, or they think they know, the minute, that Buddy
the minute
killed
they
him.
Find the body, they're like, look, we know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no
question. That's what I'm saying.
Like, you think your dad did it?
Yeah.
Like, what do you think? Jesus, of course my dad did it.
Yeah. Like I said, it is an open secret in this town that turns out to be wrong. But the reason he doesn't prosecute Hollis is because he knows people are going to believe that. And as long as there's a better story than that, that's what they'll profess to believe. But even if they believe that he killed the former sheriff, his reputation, his stock in this community is high enough that he can withstand that. And I think that makes that such an even more noble act.
Yeah.
And coming from somebody who we just keep peeling the layers back and finding out all kinds of very complicated things about. I won't say they're all negative, but there are some very complicated things going on in the past of every single one of these characters.
Buddy is not not the most upstanding guy, but he's but at the same time, the brilliance of what John Sayles does is he creates a guy who's not the most upstanding guy, but the guy that you're like, yeah, that's the kind of guy I wish I had in my corner.
Yeah.
But it makes what Hollis does even more interesting. Like, there's that great scene where Hollis is on the boat and Chris Cooper is doing his investigation, and he's just getting nervous, and he's being really shitty about how nervous he's being. And you're like, Jesus Christ, this guy is giving up the, you know, he's giving up the story so easily.
And again, going back to that John Sayles dialogue, Hollis has this great little spiel about, you know, we spend all this money on these lures to catch fish that are just minding their own business at the bottom of the lake. Doesn't really seem worth it, does it?
Yeah.
And you realize in that second, he's not fucking talking about fishing.
Well, no, and he wasn't, but you think he's talking about going after a cold case where everyone involved is dead. And what he's really talking about is
saving his own ass.
Yeah, he's talking about the fact that he killed the guy, and it's the only guy he ever killed, and he did it for a good reason. And why the fuck would you go after that fish?
Yeah.
Like, why would you put all that effort into going after a guy that you're not going to protect society by pulling him off the street? He's the reputable fucking mayor of this small town who was a deputy for years and has done nothing but good for the town, including his one act of evil, which was an act of good. He killed the bad guy, and he is terrified of getting caught by being, and it's just how subtle that dialogue is.
That moment has subtext, because even if you're like,
because Sayles is a fucking genius.
Even if you're like, well, clearly he's not talking about fishing, it's like, yeah, but he's also not talking about the thing you initially think he's talking about. Like, there are just layers upon layers, and he manages, in my opinion, to stay absolutely cohesive to each narrative layer on which he's working throughout the entirety of the story. There's never a trip up. There's never a moment where it's like, okay, well, based on what these characters know, that line of dialogue doesn't make sense, because no, he handles it all beautifully. He masterfully guides us through each and every layer. Yeah, I think it's a great film. It's absolutely a great film.
I'm so happy to hear you say that.
And clearly the Academy agreed, because the one thing we haven't mentioned this entire show is that John Sayles got nominated for Best Original Screenplay for this film.
Yeah, in an era where, you know, the 90s, the thing is the Best Original Screenplay was the gimme prize for, hey, you made one of the best movies of the year, but it didn't make a lot of money. So
when has the Academy ever cared that much about the movies that make the most money, though?
But in this era, you know, you're looking at, you know, you're here. This was the 97 Academy Awards, right? The movie was released in 96. So it was early 97. And you're looking at an era where, like, in 94, you had Forrest Gump pretty much sweeping the awards against such unknown movies as Pulp Fiction and Shawshank Redemption. In 97, you have Titanic sweeping the awards. What, 11 out of 12 awards?
Yeah.
Against such small films as like Jackie Brown and Contact and Boogie Nights and Eve's Bayou. And it, you know, here we have this era where there's so much brilliant experimental film being made. And the mainstream films are what keep getting the awards in that era. And the best original screenplay was kind of known as the Gimme Prize. The person who won that year was generally the film that was one of the best. And we saw this up through the early, you know, 2000s. And that's where we started to see a shift in the people who were the voters of the Academy. But in this era in particular, you know, the 90s were, as we talked about in the previous episode, really experimental and lots of cool stuff was happening in the 90s in filmmaking because Hollywood had no idea what works. They were just throwing shit at the wall and saw what sticks. And this is one of those where they were like, well, this guy's a brilliant filmmaker and he's been writing brilliant screenplays for years. And he's got, you know, a great little interesting cast. Let's put this thing out. And this is one of those films that in this day and age, studios would put this out, but they'd trim it by half an hour.
And to put the appropriate coat on this discussion, we started off by talking about how much Lone Star John Sayles was kind of putting his spin on the Coen Brothers formula. The movie that won Best Original Screenplay at the 69th Annual Oscars
was
Fargo. Yes.
And also with Frances McDormand.
There you go.
This was the big year that made her. That everyone's like, oh, we need her in everything. This was a wonderful era of film, especially for anybody. It was so exciting to be there seeing films in the cinema at this time. And it was really, really interesting. It was 92 to 97. And then 98 was the big kind of shrug year where everyone was like, there was interesting stuff, but it was a changing of the guard. That's where you had, you know, everyone was like, what's the best movie of the year? We're not sure. It's either this film Elizabeth, it's this film Shakespeare in Love, or it's this film Rushmore, because those were the only three great films this year.
Well, Saving Private Ryan that year as well.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just, that's... I don't even know what to say.
Yeah.
That's crazy talk.
Yeah. No, but that was, I'm talking about the indie stuff in particular.
Oh, sure.
You know, where this is the, you know, this is really what was the interesting, because at that time it's like, okay, Steven Spielberg's doing another World War II movie. Okay. That's, we'll watch that and that'll be great and all. But you know, what's going on in the indie world? Because the indie world in this 5 year era is just so interesting. And this is smack dab in the middle of that. And this was, you know, and I feel like this is where John Sayles was really let loose because his next film was good. Men with Guns, but it wasn't great. It wasn't great. Like this was like, this is so layered. And it's so brilliantly put together. And I don't think there's a flaw in this fucking film. Like everything, every frame of this film works. And McConaughey, in his three scenes, he plays the legend. Like all three of those scenes, there are three scenes. There's a scene at the beginning where he faces off with Kris Kristofferson. There's a scene where he pulls his son out of the car. And then there's the scene where he lowers the gun, Hollis's gun. And you know, where he walks in and you think that's the shootout, and that scene is shot so well. You're like, holy shit. Even watching it for like the fourth or fifth time, I forget which time it was. I was watching it again. I'm like, oh my God, he shot him. And then because McConaughey sells it in that scene, and I've completely forgotten every fucking time that no, McConaughey didn't fucking shoot him, because you kind of want to believe the legend. You want to believe McConaughey did, and he didn't.
Which is actually the legend below the legend. The legend is that he scared the sheriff out of town. And then the legend that everybody thinks they know that isn't the legend is that he actually killed. So, yeah.
But he didn't. And that's the thing, is that you find out the buddy never killed anybody. Yep. Buddy just was the guy who everybody trusted. And everybody trusted him because when the shit went down, this is how he dealt with it. He dealt with it because, as Hollis says, and is proven throughout the film, Buddy has the best sense of justice of anyone he's ever known, because Buddy really was a guy who understood justice rather than the law. And that's why he got elected year after year after year. And you buy that, and you realize at the end, you hope to God that his son doesn't go on to be sheriff until the final scene.
Yeah.
At which point you realize that's the moment where Chris Cooper becomes the son of the father, where all of a sudden he's figured it out. He's got it. He's got him dead to rights. Nobody needs to know this story. I've solved the crime. The boys in Austin, they're not going to really want to go any further with this. So, all right, we're going to let this go. I figured out who my dad was, and I'm good with that. And it's just that moment is just so powerful where it's like, holy shit. Like, this guy finally understands his dad, and he realizes as much as he spent time trying to not be his dad, he's his dad. And it's so fucking great. It's such a great human real moment steeped in legend. And it's just, and also, how cool is it that Chris Cooper is playing fucking Matthew McConaughey's dad or son?
Yeah, no.
I mean, it's flipped. Like, in this day and age, Chris Cooper would be the dad, Matthew McConaughey would be the son, and that's how it should have been. But instead, the whole time, it's the other way around. And it's just so, this movie's so fucking good.
And then his Lone Star, highly recommended, the third film of McGenre Hay. In which we are honoring Matthew McConaughey, the man, the myth, and apparently the legend.
Start digging holes in this county, no telling what will come up.
And now it's time for the junk food pairing, which for this week is going to be a basket of tortillas and a couple of Lone Stars. The tortillas because, as the movie informs us, this whole story begins with a basket of tortillas.
Over a basket of tortillas.
Which is amazing because it sounds exactly like the kind of device that any tall tale would begin with. I was like, yep, we were just sitting having a basket of tortillas, and then the shit hit the fan, and it was amazing.
It's like, oh no, the basket of tortillas has cash stuffed in it.
There you go. And Lone Star, not only because it shares the name of the title of the film, not only because they're drinking it throughout the whole film, but because it's the national fucking beer of Texas. All right. All right. And again, all right. Well, that's going to do it for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Once again, you can find us on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And Cargo, where can people find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at Massawyrm, MassawyrM, or on Facebook at facebook.com/Massawyrm.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. Or you can hop on over to oneofus.net, my home away from home. No matter what you're into, no matter what your fandom, via our various podcasts and blogs, we will have something for you. So go ahead and check that out as well. But I guess we're done. I guess that's it. I didn't write a final line to go out on because, frankly, I feel like what you guys will remember will be far better than anything I actually say, right?
You know, that the legend of how this show ended will probably be better than the actual show ending.
I agree.